Join the Toronto Holocaust Museum and its partners for a community-wide Yom HaShoah commemoration on Sunday, May 5th. A moving evening of film, candlelighting, music, and a tribute to survivors we've recently lost. Keynote speaker Yoni Berus from Yad Vashem will reflect on Holocaust remembrance post-October 7th. The program is at Beth Emeth Synagogue at 7 p.m. Register at torontoholocaustmuseum.org.
This is Bonjour Chai, the No Fans Only Poems edition. I'm Avi Feingold, and I'm here with Phoebe Maltzbovi and special guest host Erica Dreyfuss. We are your Frozen Chosen. On today's show, we are talking about literature in the literary world. What is going on with Guernica? Can you have a good poem with an odious theme? And what is the future of Jewish literature? All this and more coming up. The big topic of the week, of course. I mean, the most important thing that ever happened to anybody ever, 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 the eclipse. Physics is a big deal in your home, right? Especially astrophysics.
Yes. So my husband is an astrophysicist, and we were very excited about the eclipse in our household. And my husband made these different sort of age-appropriate ways for our two-year-old and five-year-old to kind of see the eclipse and all of this. One involved a Cheerios box being kind of retrofitted with tinfoil, and the other involved like a crafts kit, like the cardboard being kind of cut and to make a bigger mask. It was very cool looking. And then it just was so cloudy in Toronto. So we saw bits of it, but mainly it was just an early school pickup and playground trip for my children. But it was very cool. And it did get dark out and cold out in the middle of the day, which was, again, not for the first time in Toronto. So I think it felt a little bit like it's just going to rain and then it doesn't rain and it's not cloudy anymore. But it did look cool.
As my wife commented as we were like watching this from like our backyard, and we were like, 93% covered, but it's still pretty bright out. And you're like, oh, I guess the sun really is a bright object. And that was, yeah. Anyways, Phoebe, we got a great guest this week. I can't wait to talk to her.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Erica Dreyfuss, we have known each other for years and years and years through writing, blogging, things like this. We have a shared interest in French Jewish history, but I do not know you very well. And you're going to introduce yourself a little bit. And you also went to Harvard, which is a place of general interest in the world generally, but also specifically what with all the drama there. But I think today we're going to focus on literature. So who are you in the literary world? What is your work as a writer, as somebody who helps other writers?
Well, I'll try. I'll try anyway. Thank you. Thank you again for inviting me. As you said, Phoebe, we have some academic background in common. So once upon a time, like you, just earlier than you, I was a PhD student and I was specializing in French history, actually in Franco-American relations, diplomatic relations, more than anti-Semitism at the time. But I'd also always really loved writing, and that may help explain why after I earned the PhD and I was actually teaching college students at Harvard, as it happens, French history. Once I was no longer teaching history, though, and instead freelance writing and teaching writing as an adjunct and in community settings, I began to publish a newsletter. So basically, that's just to get you to sort of the starting point of the last 20 years, which is for that period of time, I have been providing information to writers through free sources. I've written lots of articles on assignment for writing magazines and websites. And I've also published lots of my own short stories and poems. And over the years, I would say in part due to my own reading and writing interests, and in part due to the evolving situation in the world and in the literary world, I have really developed a special interest in Jewish writing and resources and opportunities for Jewish writers.
Thank you. Yes. I was just wondering, so is your day job the newsletter, or is that a separate thing?
No, it isn't to do with the newsletter. So I teach, I'm back to teaching, I teach actually Jewish literature.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Okay.
So I teach at Baruch College of the City University of New York. And I sort of came into that through the Jewish Studies program, but I am basically, my courses tend to be cross-listed in English, in history, and comparative literature. So, so I do that.
Have you, since October 7th, in that, we're going to talk about the literary realm mainly, but just in the teaching realm, have there been instances where somebody says, oh, no, you can't teach Jewish literature, I can't take a Jewish literature class in these times, or has that not happened?
I have not had that happen.
Okay, that's heartening. So okay, that, yes. We are happy to hear good news also on this podcast. But I think we should get into the Guernica story, because the reason the news story that brings us here today is that the editor of Guernica, the literary magazine not so many people outside of such spheres had heard of previously and now is all over the place. Basically, its staff resigned and then its editor resigned. The staff resigned because Guernica had published an essay by, is it Joanna Chen, I assume, not Chen, an Israeli writer who is hardly a hardcore Zionist, who had herself refused to serve in the IDF and who volunteers with sick Palestinian children, driving them to hospitals in Israel. Anyway, Guernica ran an essay by her, then unpublished it because it was considered by some there to be far too Zionistic even still. But then what just happened is that the editor of Guernica, the editor-in-chief, Gina Moore, resigned, basically, because she didn't she thought that it was correct to run that essay. She disapproved of unpublishing it and made really pretty persuasive points about this. And So anyway, that's what brings us here today. So do you want to, what was your impression of Guernica Gate? Or the Guernica affair.
Please, L'affaire Guernica.
Yeah, I was going to say, we have a Dreyfus here. Yes. We have to say affair.
How is that not like become, like, it's so much better just to, for a digression. L'affaire is always better than gate.
And that's why I always use it. I always use it.
There you go. Done. Okay, as you were saying.
So, but the first thing I would like to say is that I have never met Joanna in real life, IRL, as they say, but I'm not disinterested in her work, because I think that she is a wonderful translator and writer. And she also happened to write a lovely review of my poetry book that was published a few years ago. So I am, you know, I'm very pro Joanna. I should sort of put that out there. So this piece, you know, to those of us who are accustomed to reading these sorts of essays or essays by Jewish writers, this was a very nuanced and layered piece, and expressed tremendous heartache for Palestinian suffering, but at the same time acknowledged that Israel had been through a tremendous tragedy and trauma. And that seemed to be really the issue that a lot of the critics had with the essay. I mean, I think that my sense and the sense of other Jewish writers I discussed this with was that, well, first of all, I was very surprised. I was still surprised that Guernica published it in the first place, because I have not exactly found it to be a receptive place to showcasing Israeli viewpoints that aren't virulently anti-Israel. That's sort of something that I see commonly throughout the literary world. And certainly, you know, I don't like the labels. The pro and anti labels are very reductive, but are sort of what we have to work with. Guernica has certainly been very invested in amplifying Palestinian voices, even before 10/7 and then after 10/7 as well. And I think one of the people who resigned mentioned some pride or satisfaction in having made sure that an earlier essay published by Joanna in Guernica had been excluded from a compilation of past materials from the magazine that was published, you know, sort of put together as a package after 10/7. So, you know, you have to sort of understand that it's not a new thing for Guernica not to be amplifying the idea of any sort of Israeli humanity or suffering.
Right. So you've started something called Writers Beware, What is that? Please tell us.
Okay. Well, I have
beware of, and which writers?
So, well, okay. So it's writers, comma, beware, which yes. should be distinguished from Writer Beware, which is a website that I often link to and recommend to the people in my blog and newsletter communities, because it sort of warns writers about scams, literary scams. So that's okay. Writer Beware.
Okay.
So it's kind of a okay. play on a
so
title.
I see.
Yes.
So, and what is it? What is yours?
So mine, and I hope that you'll link to it, because I'm not going to read the full one page introduction, but it is very important. I have put together a resource because you'll find in the literary world a number of statements and petitions that have some very troubling language. And I was finding that people weren't necessarily aware of all of these statements until they might happen upon them after they had submitted their work, or it was a magazine that they had something accepted and they didn't know if they should continue to have their work associated with the magazine. And all I'm doing, I'm not advocating any boycotts. I'm not advocating, you know, that funding should be withdrawn or anything like that. I'm putting out information that is publicly available from literary organizations, presses, journals, so that writers, mostly but not only Jewish writers, can know where these magazines stand when they're deciding how or whether to support magazines, whether by submitting their own work, by supporting many of these organizations have membership programs, fundraising campaigns, and so on. So it's basically to help other writers make their own informed choices. For me, because mm-hmm. of the resources that I share, the list is helpful. I consult it myself. I consult my own list because my memory is definitely not what it used to be after two COVID infections. I consult it because I'm constantly amplifying opportunities for other writers to whether to enter contests, to submit mm-hmm. their work to mm-hmm. literary magazines. And I really don't mm-hmm. want to be responsible directly in or indirectly for sure. pushing or sort of steering anyone to a publication or organization they may later feel have regrets
so
about.
That's specifically
with.
The part I wanted to kind of hone in on, because there was just this Jewish Book Council hotline basically for anti-Semitic literary incidents. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to make sense of what that means. What is an anti-Semitic literary incident? What, because it seems like this is the sort of thing that could, that a lot of different people would define in different ways. So how do you understand this? What do you consider to be, what should one be aware of? Because like, I certainly wouldn't think that the fact that a publication runs work by Palestinians, that does not seem like a reason to avoid a publication.
No.
I doubt any of us would
no.
think that. But what would be, however, a concern?
So here I will again refer you to the full page that I wrote, because it's not easy to distill to a soundbite. Well, Phoebe, it's not a matter that of amplifying Palestinian voices itself. It's a matter
right.
of amplifying the language of accusing Israel of genocide, of ignoring everything that happened before the IDF's arrival in Gaza this last fall and so forth, of ahistorical or at least contestable descriptions of history and current politics, such as talking about occupied Gaza when most of us are aware that Israel withdrew from Gaza, or most.
So just right. to interrupt, so just your I just wanted to ask, so do you mean when you say about all these different things, the same publication, like the New York Times runs op-eds with people of all sort of divergent views. If a literary magazine has a poem about occupied Gaza and from the river to the sea, and also runs stuff by Jewish writers that has not that type of slant to it, would that be something to be aware of? Or would that be something that's wonderful, all these different views?
That would not be something that would go on my list. You know, what I'm talking about, and I really, I'm just going to say, because again, sound bites and short discussions are difficult, to better understand what my project is here, I really hope that people will go to the list, read.
But Erica, I wish that they would, but the thing is, the listeners to a podcast.
Yes. Well, this is why I am not a frequent podcast guest.
No. I mean, we're more than happy to have you here.
I think it raises a larger point though, Phoebe, and this is part of the problem, because a lot of language and slogans get thrown around on Twitter by writers, by literary journals. So we get things like Israel's genocide, you know, the U.S. complicit with genocide. And what I try to highlight again, and the list, first of all, after you get through my one page introduction, you do get to a very carefully hyperlinked set of collective statements from organizations of writers. You will then find the list of individual literary or literary adjacent journals, presses, groups, and organizations, and so on. And when you read, again, you know, some of us, a lot of these definitions and so forth are very contestable. For a lot of us, we sort of, you know, we feel it in our kishkas. We know when something is really coming from animus and not from, you know, mere misguided, lack of knowledge.
Let me ask you something. It sounds like what you're saying is that there is a strong current within the literary world that is anti-Israel, that will not just amplify Palestinian voices, but will seek to shut down Israeli voices for the ideas that they contain, or even just because they are these individuals. Has this ever happened historically? Like, if you bracket the entire Israel-Palestine discussion 20 years ago, 30 years ago, was there a general consensus that you couldn't publish an essay that was titled, "My Father Was a Nazi, you know, my feelings are complicated about this, I'm torn," or, you know, "I was part of the Rwandan genocide, and this is not as simple as you think it is," right? Were there ideas, or was it just as long as this was well written and had
there was that one that "my family had slaves" article. Do you remember this?
Vaguely. But,
okay, but anyway.
Again, so that's one. So I'm trying to figure out, were there streams of this beforehand and that this is just the latest, or is this something that's really out of the blue where until recently or in the long literary history, this had never happened, and now all of a sudden you have this, "we're going to cancel you," not Israel-Palestine related?
Oh, that I don't know. I'm not, this is not my full, you know, my full time area of expertise. This is something I've sort of undertaken as literary community service.
Maybe a way to shift it to something you might be able to speak to more would be, what's different since October 7th? Because I am not a creative writer myself. I am extremely uncreative in my writing, but my sense of it is that those spheres are both kind of one of these things where it's high stakes because there's so little money at stake often. You know, like many literary communities, I know some poets who, like, from what they describe, it's like people are always mad at each other precisely because the stakes are sort of like, it's a labor of love. And, you know, that can lead to a lot of high stakes and drama and cancellations and call outs and all of this. So that obviously predates October 7th. But what I'm wondering about is, to do with Jews and anti-Semitism specifically, does it look very different since October 7th than it did before, than it did on October 6th?
It's just massively amplified. It's, you know, I think that a lot of things that you only saw external evidence occasionally, it's now much more steady, much more pronounced, and much more pervasive.
How much of it, I wonder if you can comment a bit on what Phoebe was mentioning about the fact that these are really small communities, relatively speaking, that people are doing it out of love. Like, it didn't occur to me until I read that the entire Guernica staff is entirely volunteer. And it feels like the difference between the Atlantic and their literary offerings, or whatever they're planning on publishing, or the New York Times, or any other major publication, is confident in their abilities to promote Israeli authors and Palestinian authors and to have both sides be discussed, whereas smaller places really end up defining themselves by these small differences and say to themselves, well, no, we have to define ourselves by this, and this is our idea, and we have to, stick to it really, really strongly.
Well, Avi, I would have two responses to that. First is that these aren't all very small places. One of them, for instance, Literary Hub, is a very large publication with a massive social media outreach. Was also, until recently, was their coverage of anything related to what's happening over in Israel and Gaza in terms of writers and literary matters was picked up by Publishers Weekly and circulated that way. So it's not so small. And the second thing is that for writers, many of us, including me, begin publishing creative work in many of these smaller journals. And so it really does matter. You have a fairly...
I'm not saying that it doesn't matter. Yeah. I'm saying that like...
Well, I think it's almost that it matters more. I mean, I think that that's because I think... It feels more personal, maybe, if that makes sense. Like if you are working at Guernica and you're doing that not for pay, yeah, obviously, if you lose your job at Guernica, you are not, you know, unable to pay rent because it was not contributing to your ability to pay rent, at least not directly. But you were doing it because you considered that a really valuable use of your time and something you cared about.
I would also add that many of these journals and organizations that are listed on my document that people won't look at
I make no promises.
They do receive funding from large mm-hmm. organizations and government organizations and mm-hmm. arts councils and so forth. So, they're not exactly just all, you know, little plucky, you know, from my basement. Mm-hmm. Computer, you know, projects.
It's not just zines.
They are right. They are slick, mm-hmm. Organizations.
So this is a kind of a perfect segue to what I also wanted to ask you about, namely Only Poems.
Yes.
I had never previously heard of Only Poems because, as I said, my writing is not creative in the least. But for those who are creatively inclined, Only Poems, what is it? Does it have a big reach? All I could tell about it before they blocked me on Twitter was they did block me. That they pay $55 for something. I don't know what it is that they pay $55 for, given that their name is Only Poems, I would assume. What is Only Poems and why was that? How did you brush up against Only Poems recently?
I first brushed up against Only Poems because someone on their staff reached out to me and asked if I would list them in my newsletter because, as you said, they will pay. $55 for a poet is actually a lot of money to be their featured poet. It's a fair amount of money. Also, they have every month, they have, I think it's the first week that they don't charge submission fees. Because another fun fact that your listeners may not know is that in addition to receiving zero or very little money for their poems, poets often pay submission fees to have their work considered.
Really?
Yes. And those fees...
I'm going to start a poetry journal.
Bonjour, hi.
And you'll end up on a different writer beware list.
I don't mind. I'll be on the white list. If your poem is pro-Israel, send it in for $10. We will consider it. And if we publish it, we will pay you $5.
Well, all right. I'm happy to come generous. Back for another session about submission fees. But the reason I mention it is because what makes my newsletter, I think, what draws people in is that I do filter for opportunities that do not charge fees and pay you for your work. So that's what makes my newsletter.
So what is Only Poems? Is it, it's a publication?
Yes.
It's an online publication?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And they reached out to you?
They reached out to me and they asked if I would list them. And then they also said, you know, since we have these repeated, submission periods, maybe you could mention us repeatedly or so forth. That's my recollection of it anyway. And I was actually listing them fairly often. They wrote back to me and said, we thought you were going to mention us again. And I said, if you keep reading, you know, go again, they're not the best with evidence and close reading because they actually were listed. They admitted they didn't read thoroughly.
Just haikus for Only Poems.
Right. And then they wrote to me and asked if I would list, they have a new contest coming up. And I said, well, you know, I looked at your guidelines and you charge a fee. And as you know, I don't list anything that charges a fee. So sorry, no, I can't list your contest.
So Only Poems, what, as I recall, what happened was they ran a poem that
It was called Decolonization Gazelle with a smartphone in my hand.
Yes. And what was the line that jumped out at many?
I don't remember the line.
It was something about dancing on the graves of colonizers. Am I with lol, LOL, like laughing out loud?
Yes, there's lots of LOLs.
Okay. Okay. So there, basically, this poem came across as perhaps not merely a criticism of the way the Israeli government runs things, but perhaps something a little bit more on the anti-Semitism realm of things. And a Jewish writer wrote a letter to Only Poems.
An email,
a private email, saying basically this was upsetting for me. Not saying I'm canceling you, not saying, and now I'm going to withdraw the $1 billion I used to fund Only Poems, because there's no reason to think that anybody is funding Only Poems. But basically saying, like, this made me sad. It gave me a feeling. Why did you do this? And Only Poems, rather than replying to this person, rather than ignoring it, as most people do with most email, Only Poems tweeted it out. They did not tweet the person's name. They posted to X, formerly still basically Twitter, a screenshot of this email and basically asked, as though asking for advice, how would you respond to this? And they got sort of different waves of response. So first were from their kind of, the people very much on the team Only Poems were saying, well, we would respond by educating this person about their privilege and about being a colonizer and like, get over yourself and think of Gazans and blah, 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 went like that, sort of like we would respond that this person should be quiet and not have a feeling about this poem. And then you get the people who, as always happens in these kind of online controversies, you get the people who are not in the inner circle and who may have different views. And I think, Erica, that may be where you enter the story a little bit. Is that right?
I think that you've summarized it fairly well there. The one thing I'll add is that in addition to posting the screenshot and asking for advice, I think there was, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but it was something was added by the Only Poems account, like, we're confident that once this person, you know, this person can be made to understand what it means to stand with the oppressed or something like
right,
that.
That's
you
right.
Know?
That's right. They weren't neutral in this matter.
No, but and that's where another person someone on Twitter saw this and called my attention to it by tagging me and suggesting that, you know, that this was some sort of anti-Semitic platforming, which I really wasn't sure about, especially since it was getting towards Shabbat on a Friday. And I really tried to be offline as much as possible on Shabbat. So then later over the weekend, I looked at it. And again, what I was brought into was about this letter or the message that was being raised. But in order to sort of understand why the letter writer or message writer had been so upset, I went back, I read the poem. You know, the poem was not something personally that I admire or care to read. But when I looked at the page with the poem, the web page with the poem, there was also, you know, like the poet had a poet statement and the editors had issued a statement. And when you read the two statements about the poem and why the poet, you know, what the poet's perspective on the poem is and why the editors chose it, that's where, again, we get into this view of the conflict and erasure of Israeli/Jewish experience that shows, I think, editorial, I would like to say editorial malpractice, but that's my view. And that's what I point people to. If you want your work considered by an editorial group with this perspective and so forth, like, know about that. And it may be, you know, not worth your time to spend the fee on the writing contest to send in your poems about, you know, your
so
family in Israel.
So how did they respond to you? How did they respond to you?
Not well.
Okay.
I wrote about this in my newsletter. I didn't deal with it on Twitter because, again, it was not something really to deal with in 280 characters. But shortly after that newsletter went out, I was alerted on Twitter again that that Only Poems was proud to stand on, to be on my list and in the company of so many excellent publications, and they tag the other publications to kind of draw them into it. Because again, when I've kept this list, I'm not doing it to try to, even though I keep telling people to read it, I haven't done it to try to draw attention to myself. I have not tagged everybody who's on the list, come look at yourself on my list. With Only Poems, I did, you know, they were tagged in my newsletter because we had this ongoing relationship, and I felt it was fair to let them know, you know, not that they wouldn't have seen it anyway, but that you know, this was a, I had an extended discussion of their journal in my newsletter.
So with literary things, we're asking ourselves, well, are you cutting it because it's a bad poem or because you, the content you find distasteful or whatever it might be? And I think that that's the piece that, you know, seems to be unspoken here, but I think is at the core of it, right? Are literary journals or is the literary world trying to be more, you know, like a news organization that says this is our perspective and that that's a problem? Or are they able to hide behind the fact that, you know, literarily, you seem to be clearly saying that these are all organizations that are basically saying we want to cut out Israel, because not because these pieces are poorly written, but because we don't like these things. Right? We don't like what the author is saying.
If I could jump in on that beyond just the specific sphere of poetry, this idea that all art, all cultural production, every TV show, every novel, every play, every pair of sneakers, that every single thing that comes, that appears in the world is an op-ed. This has been the case now for like a decade. Basically, the people who are in cultural jobs, in volunteer or paid, have decided effectively that no, that it's all about being in the service of the right politics. What has happened, I think, since October 7th is that there has been this rift within the people who have the so-called correct politics, where you have people who think Israel shouldn't exist at all, and you have people who are very, very critical of Israel, but do not go to that point. And that's basically the divide among people who are even in these spaces to begin with. You also have like right-wing artistic communities that kind of like to be flagrantly outrageous and say racist things, and that's what they're going for, and they want to be outrageous in that way. But what I'm getting at is that the mainstream sort of cultural sphere has been extremely sort of politically monolithic for quite a while. And what's new, I think, is that there's any sort of divide, and it's a divide on this. What I'm saying is, in terms of, if you're asking, are you asking like Erica and me whether we think like good literature can have bad politics? I mean, I do, but I don't think that that's really what's at stake in this particular debate. I don't think Only Poems is claiming to think like that. Like, I don't think they're claiming to just judge the artistic quality of a poem. I don't think that's where they're coming from. But what I really wanted to ask Erica about, because I don't want to have missed this, is basically, given that that is what the literary landscape is like, has there been, since October 7th, a flourishing of either Jewish publications, Zionist publications, not anti-Zionist publications, if that makes sense, like Zionism neutral publications? Has there been kind of a counter sphere appearing for creative writers? Like, are there new journals forming? What are there networks, like back channels in the interest of forming such things, since it's a little early to have maybe gotten something printed? Is there anything on the horizon in that realm?
So the answer happily is yes, there are signs of that. One of them is called Green Golem, which is new and has announced that it does have an explicitly Zionist or welcoming Zionist voices. There is a project that started in Israel called Writing on the Wall, which is offering a chance to post writings and is also offering workshops. I took one of their writing workshops, their virtual workshops, for writers trying to write about or through this period. And there are one or two others. They're small. Most of them, at least as far as I'm aware, are not paying writers anything. So it's one of those things where you're just, you know, sharing your work basically without compensation. And I think that, you know, what you referred to before, the Jewish Book Council's effort has at least given a lot of writers a sense that there's a place where they can be heard and report their concerns. What the Jewish Book Council is ultimately going to do with that information has yet to be made clear, I think, to mm-hmm. all of us.
I had wondered about that. Yeah.
So that's one thing. And then there's another organization called the Artists Against Antisemitism, which is open to artists beyond literary artists, but really got its start with a large group of mostly women fiction writers, Jewish women fiction writers. And their first project was to have an auction where a lot of us, including me, donated books and other things to raise money to support Project Shema, which is an organization that handles anti-Semitism education, including the sort of difficult tensions between anti-Semitism and Israel, anti-Israelism and anti-Zionism.
I just wanted to ask about this specifically because I'm sure there are more initiatives, it sounds like, but what I wanted to ask is just whether this is purely a good thing that has emerged. Like, obviously it's heartening relative to there not being, but I guess what I'm wondering is just about like the siloing effect, because like, especially I know more the US context, but also in Canada, Jews have been really, really central to the, not central as in like controlling it in some sinister way, but Jews have been a major presence in the literary landscape for quite a long time in the English speaking world in North America. And the idea, something feels bleak and like a backtrack of this idea that Jewish writers are in the one corner and then writers are in the other corner. You know what I mean? Like there's something about this that seems...
Phoebe, you're starting a literary journal calling it the ghetto.
Well, that's effectively what this seems like to, in a way. I mean, and not entirely. Like I think there's definitely a need for sort of support networks. And certainly if you want to have a politically engaged pro-Israel journal, that is something specific, and that is obviously not going to ever be of general interest. But the idea of like, I'm just picturing like Philip Roth having to write for like the Jewish stuff only, you know what I mean? Like that seems a little, you know, that's not how it was decades ago. And then if since October 7th, that's where things are going, there's something potentially concerning there as well. Like it's heartening and concerning. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. And what it reminds me of is, you know, some of the recent discussions about what's going on campuses and whether Jews should be advocating to be included or considered, you know, under the sort of DEI rubrics. You know, we are a group. Mm-hmm. You just have to understand that a lot of the changes that have been going on in the larger culture have been happening in the literary world. And so there are mm-hmm. groups that are recognized as, you know, let's call them affinity groups, mostly identitarian mm-hmm. Affinity groups for, you know, every kind of writer out there. And they are supposed to, you know, they sort of support and nourish and advocate for themselves. And they are part of the larger literary sphere. And ideally, we can have that too. I think mm-hmm. there has been a significant problem in sort of a lack of organizational infrastructure for Jewish writers. If you go to these conferences, you know, sort of there's every sort of identity focused writing is acknowledged. Sure. And very often, if it's acknowledged at all, Jewish things are, you know, a panel about Holocaust writing or so on, or you know, Jewish writers against Israel sort of panel. Mm-hmm. So I do think that all of, you know, what you've brought up, these are concerns. I'm not sure where it's all going to go and where it's navigated, but mm-hmm. I think that the moment calls for something to be happening. And that, again, as we mm-hmm. sort of figure out, as we, meaning the Jewish community, sort of navigate these waters in other areas, we have to do it in this one as well.
I was just going to say that the Guernica thing, well, the fact that Joanna Hen's article didn't end up in a Jewish publication, but it found a home in Washington Monthly, which is a mainstream publication, suggests that this is not the world out to get Jews in all contexts.
I mean, I think that part of what a lot of these organizations, like for instance, the Artists Against Antisemitism, is trying. I mean, and I think the Jewish Book Council is trying to help educate and explain to some of these organizations. I mean, I don't think that every conference, and well, I know for a fact because of past experiences and back channeling and so forth, is aware when a panel proposal comes in from Jewish writers with, you know, all sorts of code language about Israel and anti-Zionism and so forth, I'm not sure that they know how to recognize what may be playing into anti-Semitic tropes and rhetoric. And I think that some of that ongoing work, which, you know, really should have been happening much more earlier, will hopefully now happen because there will be resources devoted to it. It becomes mm-hmm. so obvious that there is a need for to have it happen.
It sounds like you're doing yeoman's work or yeoperson's work, and I applaud you. This is can't possibly be easy, but it does sound bleak because, as you said, you know, there always have been literary Jewish literary venues and journals and
absolutely.
You know, spaces, but to think that we are moving to a place where that's the only thing mm-hmm. that Jews will have is kind of sad. But let's hope that the work in shifting the perception and awakening to this idea that, like, well, we shouldn't be judging things based on political merit, but is hopefully, you know, a hopeful path for the future. But I'm not sure where that's going. Erica, thank you so much for coming on Bonjour Chai.
Thank you.
This has been Most Enlightening.
Are you in the market for a new watch or a special piece of jewelry? Are you looking for the perfect engagement ring to pop the question? Atelier Lou has all this and more. Eric and the team at Atelier Lou can craft a piece for you, or you can select from some of the exclusive designers that they offer. From a simple bangle to a statement necklace, Atelier Lou can make you or your loved one sparkle. Located in the heart of Westmount in Montreal or online at atelierlou.com, visit Atelier Lou for your next watch or jewelry purchase. And when you do, make sure to use promo code BON18 for 10% off your next purchase. That's atelierlou.com.
It's time for our weekly Nachas for Bruegges. Erica, do you have a Nachas for us?
I do. And it's in keeping with something that I also try to emphasize a lot, which is to continue amplifying Jewish literary voices and Israeli literary voices. I mean, there's some really wonderful literature out there. And I've recently read the first book translated into English by the Israeli writer Maya Arad. The translation is by Jessica Cohen. Many of us owe much of our reading of Israeli literature to Jessica Cohen, is a really well-known, well-regarded translator. And it's a book of three novellas titled The Hebrew Teacher. And the first novella is the title one, The Hebrew Teacher. And that was my favorite in this book. And it really speaks to this moment, even though it was published in Hebrew several years ago. I can't recommend it enough. So it's published by New Vessel Press. Not sure about Canadian distribution, forgive me. I should have checked that before I came on. But The Hebrew Teacher by Maya Arad.
Excellent. Phoebe, what's your nachas this week?
So mine is a nachas with a tinge of Bruegges. Is that allowed?
Always.
Okay.
Always. And Phoebe, I would not expect anything less from you.
I try. So I'm doing this in keeping with the people I have known through blogging for decades at this point theme. This is the law professor in the U.S., David Traub, has a blog called The Debate Link. And his post is called from April 9th is, "You can't accept me if I reject you second." And it's about some pretty... I shouldn't say funny, but it is a little funny drama in San Francisco at its Contemporary Jewish Museum, where there's a group of seven artists, but these are seven anti-Zionist Jewish artists, not the group of seven Canada style.
The different group of seven.
Different group of seven wanted their work displayed at this Contemporary Jewish Museum and were sort of like, but sort of almost like defying them, like, "Will you show our giant Free Palestine exhibit or whatever?" And they were like, "Yeah, we will. That's fine." And then they didn't know what to do, it sounds like. They basically didn't know what to do once they got the yes that they had supposedly asked for. So then they made all these extra demands about how the museum fund itself and how they display the artwork and whether it's near Zionist artwork or not. And they basically, they wanted to micromanage it in a way that made it impossible. And then it sounds like the museum, so this, I'm quoting from David Traub now, "The museum incidentally will display prominent blank spaces where the artist's work would have hung to symbolize their non-presence and draw attention to their decision to withdraw from the relevant community," which I think is fabulous. So that's David Traub thinks it's fabulous. I also think that sounds about right. And I think this is what I thought was so funny about this story is that you hear so much about the sort of silencing aspects of this. It's just interesting to see a group of seven sort of expecting this cancellation that didn't happen. I also personally, because I study these culture wars things, also in non-Jewish contexts, always find it funny when people sort of insist that they're going to be canceled and then they aren't. I just, those are just like the funniest things to me. So this did happen though, also to do with this specific conflict of quite a few months ago at this point, where somebody tweeted like, I bet none of the Harper's letter signatories are going to call out this person being fired from their job for being pro-Palestinian. And like, you could look and like several Harper's signatories had already said this person should not have been fired for their job for being pro-Palestinian. Anyway, that is my nachas is David Traub's blog post that sums this all up.
Yeah, I love this. And I love the Contemporary Jewish Museum. I have a mezuzah from them.
It looks like the Rom. I'm looking at this picture, and I thought that was a picture of the Rom.
Well, it's because Liebskind designed both of them, Daniel Liebskind.
Well, that would explain it. It has the Liebskind touch.
And I have the Liebskind mezuzah from the Contemporary Jewish Museum. It's always something that reminds me of that on our front door. Anyways.
And Avi, what have you got?
I am going in a completely different direction. It's pure nachas. I've been doing a lot of research for a piece that I've been doing for the distant future, because this is what I'm learning is magazine writing. You write for like a year from now. Not quite a year from now, but far enough in advance. And I'm doing a piece on music, and I'm doing a lot of music research. And I discovered a wonderful little Substack about Jewish music called Oyer.fm. And it really... it's one of those that covers the waterfront. I mean, it's got Haredi music, it's got klezmer, it's got electronic everything. It's really, really a good cross-section of what Jewish music is reviewing it in a really fun, enlightening sort of way. I guess it's sort of like a Jewish pitchfork, but we don't believe in Satan. I don't know. Anyways, go check that out. It was fun and interesting, and it'll give you more music for your ears. But that's about it. Erica, wonderful to have you here. Phoebe, great episode again.
Thank you so
much. Thank you both.
Thank you for listening to Moshe Chai for the week ending April 13th, Shabbat Parashat Tazria. The show is produced by Michael Freeman and edited by Zach Kaufman. The executive producer for CJN Podcast is Michael Freeman. Our music is by So-Called. We are a project of the Jewish Living Lab and are distributed by the CJN Podcast Network. You can listen to all our past episodes on our page at thecjn.ca/bonjour, and you can subscribe to the podcast and automatically receive all episodes on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you told a friend about Moshe Chai. It is always one of the best ways we get new listeners. As always, please do email us with comments at bonjour@thecjn.ca.